George Kiefer Brewer was a struggling actor who wanted desperately to break into Hollywood. After several small roles, his place as an icon of the golden age of entertainment would be solidified when he changed his name to George Reeves and donned the famous red cape and blue tights on The Adventures of Superman. Much like his fictional counterpart, Reeves soared to new highs of popularity and became the living image of everybody's first superhero. Every week on television, Reeves would battle against villains and monsters, always overcoming the odds, and showing the meaning of persistence as the embodiment of truth, justice, and the American way. However, beneath the glossy veneer of polished Hollywood life, George was a man whose successes were not always guaranteed, and he struggled with difficult life choices, feelings of failure, and fears of being typecast. He came from a broken home, with a father who left at an early age and a mother who was controlling and manipulative. Determined to make it, Reeves went to New York and did stage work before a lucky break would bring him back to the glitz and glam of Hollywood. He was offered the title role on The Adventures of Superman, and despite his distaste for television, he accepted and became forever indistinguishable from the DC Comics superhero. Along the way, he met and fell in love with Toni Mannix, a woman 9 years his senior who happened to be married to Eddie Mannix, an executive at MGM who wasn't afraid to dabble in the criminal world when he needed to get something done. Eddie reportedly approved of the affair and took a liking to George. Both Toni and Eddie were devout Catholics, and as a result couldn't divorce, and so they indulged one another's proclivities. George and Toni were together for nearly 9 years, during which time Toni rained down gifts and money on George, even purchasing him a home in the hills. Toni was always worried that George would eventually meet a young, single woman and leave her, and in 1958, her worst fears came to be a reality. George met and fell in love with New York socialite Lenore Lemon, and the two embarked on a whirlwind romance that was heavily steeped in the partying lifestyle. Both George and Lemon were heavy drinkers, and as time went on, the tension between them became palpable, with George's closest friends choosing to remove themselves from the situation, not wanting to be around the fiery Lemon. In the last months of his life, George was the subject of multiple threatening phone calls and was nearly killed in car accidents on 3 separate occasions. The final one having been caused when someone drained the brake fluid from his vehicle and George careened out of control. Finally, on June 15, 1959, Lemon and Reeves got into a heated argument at Chasen's Restaurant in West Hollywood. Shortly thereafter, they returned home and went to bed, though they were awoken around midnight by neighbors looking for a nightcap. George was in a foul mood, though he joined his guests for one last drink. He said goodnight and excused himself, heading to his upstairs bedroom while Lemon alleges that she stayed downstairs. Just moments later, the sound of a gunshot rang out, and George Reeves was dead of an apparent suicide. In the immediate aftermath of his death, many questions began rising to the surface, and while the LAPD conducted what can only be referred to as one of the most slack and lazy investigations in history, friends and family demanded answers, and denied even the remote possibility that George would have committed suicide, just as his career was beginning to hit its second wind. When the smoke cleared, the police stuck to their theory of suicide, despite several pieces of evidence suggesting otherwise. To this day, the death of George Reeves remains a fascinating and disturbing mystery. Did George Reeves commit suicide that night due to depression, or as the result of a practical joke gone wrong? Did his drunk and violent fiancée pull the trigger, either out of malice or by accident? Did his ex-girlfriend, Toni Mannix, hire a hitman to eliminate the man she once loved who had scorned her? Or did Toni's husband, Eddie Mannix, hire one of his underworld connections to have George murdered in order to protect his own reputation and that of his wife's? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 22, The Suspicious Death of George Reeves. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode looks into one of Hollywood's most infamous mysteries. The death of Superman star George Reeves is a complex story with several theories and suspects. The ultimate ruling of police was that Reeves committed suicide, though many question that ruling to this day. It's a mystery I've always been fascinated by and have been looking to take on for a while. Before moving into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on missing persons and unsolved murders. We are available across multiple platforms and we're on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and many more. Trace Evidence has a Patreon for those of you who wish to support the podcast. It can be found at patreon.com/traceevidence. This podcast is a complete one-man operation, so if you enjoy it and wish to help support it, please check out the Patreon page. I've also set up a one-time PayPal donation link on the main website for those of you who wish to contribute but don't want to use Patreon. Links, information, and more items, including YouTube videos and full episode transcripts, can be found on the website at trace-evidence.com. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Tweet me at traceevpod, that's TRACEEVPOD. Add me on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence Podcast or clicking the direct link on our website. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. And as a final note, if you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on whatever app or platform you're listening on. The more ratings and reviews we get, the easier it becomes to find the podcast, and the more attention can be given to these cases. Today I look into the death of George Reeves. It's a story you may have heard before, though whether or not you heard the whole story depends on who was telling it. There are a lot of sides to this mystery, and with every new detail, the question of what really happened to George Reeves becomes even more complex. This is episode 22, The Suspicious Death of George Reeves. George Kiefer Brewer, later known by his stage name George Reeves, was born on January 5, 1914 in Woolstock, Iowa. He was the son of Donald Carl Brewer and Helen Lesher, born just 5 months after the two were married. The marriage was a tumultuous one, with both parents feeling unhappy in their situation, and the inclusion of a newborn child did nothing to quell the spats and only contributed to the disdain on both sides. It has long been suggested that the marriage itself was forged due to Helen becoming pregnant rather than due to a mutual interest in pursuing a life together. Shortly after George was born, Donald and Helen separated, with Helen moving back to her hometown of Galesburg, Illinois, and taking her infant son with her. Helen and George's time in Galesburg was short-lived. Being a single mother with a young boy was a challenging lifestyle, and seeking familial support, the two moved to California, where they would live with Helen's sister. Sometime around 1925, Helen met and married Frank Joseph Besolo while in California. George's father, Donald Brewer, also became married to a woman named Helen Schultz around the same time. George would never see his real father again, but 2 years later, in 1927, Frank Besolo would officially adopt 13-year-old George, who would then become known as George Besolo. The relationship between Helen and Frank seemed to be a much more suitable situation than her first attempt at marriage, and during this time, the three lived as a family. While attending high school at the Polytechnic School, George became fascinated by acting, and it became a true passion in his life. He also pursued an interest in boxing. Shortly after he graduated, George attended Pasadena Junior College and began studying acting at the famous Pasadena Playhouse, which boasts it being the starting point for film stars such as Gene Hackman and Dustin Hoffman. At the Pasadena Playhouse, George met and fell in love with Eleonora Needles, a beautiful dark-haired actress. While both were working together to expand their careers, their affection for one another was undeniable. In 1939, George received his first big break, being cast as Stuart Tarleton in Gone with the Wind. He would be playing a male suitor to Vivian Leigh's Scarlett O'Hara. It was hardly a large role, but it was a foot in the door to Hollywood that George was desperate to enter. He appears in the opening scene, and his work on the film caught the attention of others as he was offered a contract with Warner Brothers soon after completing work on the film. It was on this contract where George's name was officially changed to George Reeves. Around this time, George's mother Helen divorced Frank Besselow. Strangely, she would tell her son that Frank committed suicide, much to his devastation. It wouldn't be until years later that George discovered that Frank was in fact still alive, and this would severely strain relations with his mother. On September 22, 1940, George and Eleonora were married in the Church of Our Savior, San Marino. The two initiated a honeymoon while George was working on a film, and so they honeymooned in Southern California. When George finished, they went up to San Francisco for the second half of their honeymoon. The two found a home in Pasadena, which is where they would live for the entirety of their marriage. After his work on Gone with the Wind, George appeared in four other films for Warner Brothers, all of which released prior to Gone with the Wind due to the epic scope of the film. Despite the fact that Gone with the Wind was his first role, it appears as fifth in his list due to the delay between filming and release. The next few years would have a lot of ups and downs for George's career. He began appearing in short films and worked with bigger names in a few B-movies, namely James Cagney and future President Ronald Reagan. George was loaned out by Warner Brothers to appear in a film called Lydia, but after its poor showing at the box office, George was released from his contract. He was quickly picked up by 20th Century Fox, but only appeared in a few pictures before they released him as well. At this point, George began working freelance and appeared in several other smaller roles before being picked up and cast as Lieutenant John Summers in the World War II drama So Proudly We Hail, produced by Paramount. Just when it appeared that George's acting career may be getting a boost, in early 1943, the 29-year-old was drafted into the Army. The director of So Proudly We Hail, Mark Sandrich, promised George he would have roles lined up for him when he returned. George was assigned to the U.S. Army Air Forces and performed in a show for them entitled Winged Victory, which would later become a popular feature film. Reeves was transferred into the 1st Motion Pictures Unit, a film production unit of the Army Air Forces made up of professional actors, writers, and directors who would make training and propaganda films to help the war effort. At the completion of the war, Reeves returned to a changed Hollywood in which many studios were tightening their budgets and work had become harder to find. Unfortunately for George, Mark Sandrich, the man who had promised him work when he was free, passed away in March of 1945, just months before George left the military. George appeared in a few low-budget productions, but his career seemed to be going in a different direction than he had planned. Whether it be due to issues stemming from the time apart during the war, George's frustration with Hollywood, or stresses related to money, George and Eleonora separated, and George moved to New York in 1949. Their divorce would become official 1 year later. George began working on various radio programs and television shows while in New York, though he always thought of it as being beneath what he truly wanted to do. Many major Hollywood stars at the time didn't view television as serious acting, and George tended to agree with their sentiment. However, he needed a paycheck, and so he did what he could to make do. In 1951, George returned to Hollywood to attempt once again to get his big break in film, but ironically, it would be television where George would become a permanent fixture of pop culture and Hollywood itself. Reeves was approached to play Superman in a film entitled Superman and the Mole Men. He took on the job as it was work and he needed to make a living, but when they immediately offered him the starring role as Superman in a television series to follow up the film, he was hesitant. Reeves was unimpressed with the world of television and didn't like the tight schedules and rapid-fire scene filming. Despite his resistance to the idea, Reeves agreed, and after production of Superman and the Mole Men was finished, he and crew immediately moved on to 13 weeks of filming the television series in the summer of 1951. Reeves wasn't pleased with his contract, which limited his ability to pursue other acting roles. Neither he nor any other actor on the series was allowed to take any role which could interfere with the shooting schedule, and even during a break, it would be difficult to get work, since the contract required that the studio only give the actors 4 weeks' notice when the new season shoot was about to begin. This made it impossible to take on stage work or any roles which could have long runs. Phyllis Coates, who would play Lois Lane in the first season of The Adventures of Superman, described her initial meeting with George as follows. Quote, George invited me over and made us a martini, and he said, here's to the bottom of the barrel. And that's how I first met George. End quote. When asked about what she thought of George as a person, Coates stated that he was, quote, a decent human being, a fun-loving, kind, generous, decent human being, end quote. Jack Larson, another of George's co-stars, described him as, quote, the people's friend, end quote. Noel Neal, who took over the role of Lois Lane starting in the second season, said of George, quote, he was so kind, such a gentleman, as opposed to so many people in this business, he just couldn't have been sweeter, end quote. By 1952, the show was purchased and aired on the ABC network, gaining more exposure for the cast. Despite his distaste for the role he was playing and the format on which it appeared, George took it seriously. While behind the scenes he joked about his job and referred to his cape and tights as his monkey suit, in public he was extremely dedicated to the ideals and image of Superman. George was a smoker at the time, but began going out of his way to make sure he was never seen smoking in public, and eventually quit altogether. He made many appearances as Superman for various charities and organizations, and at the end of every season, he would cut the Superman S logo off of all of his costumes and send them to children who were sick in hospitals. George wasn't all pure, though, despite an attempt to keep his private life discreet. He was a heavy drinker, and it wasn't uncommon for him to be out late into the early morning hours drinking and partying hard. In addition to his partying lifestyle, George was involved in an affair with Toni Mannix, the wife of MGM general manager Eddie Mannix. For many, this was considered the worst-kept secret in Hollywood, as it had been alleged that Eddie not only knew of his wife's affair, but approved. According to several sources close to the situation, Eddie and Toni had long since lost their luster for one another, but were Catholic, and for them, the idea of divorce was simply not an option. So the two are alleged to have looked the other way at each other's trysts and maintained their marriage only as a front to the public. Toni was an attractive, elegant woman who'd begun her career in Hollywood as a member of the famed Ziegfeld Follies. She later met and became the mistress to Eddie Mannix before the two were married in 1951, and not long after which Toni met and began an affair with George Reeves. Rumors abound about the possible dark connections for Eddie, with many speculating that he had ties to the mafia and that he had his first wife Bernice murdered. He was also considered a key player in the cover-up of MGM's Paul Burns suicide. The rumor was that Eddie was the man you went to when you had a problem that needed fixing, and legal wasn't an option. Many people referred to him as the most dangerous man in Hollywood. It's been said that outside of underworld connections, Eddie also employed crooked cops and private eyes. It's been alleged that Eddie was heavily involved in covering up an incident in which Clark Gable is purported to have accidentally killed actress Tosca Rulin, and he had tracked down and destroyed prints of a pornographic film which starred a young Joan Crawford. While Eddie clearly knew about the affair with Reeves, many believe that he was simply waiting for the right time to get revenge. Toni was 9 years George's senior, was rich, and would lavish him with gifts. One of these gifts would be a modest two-story home located at 1579 Benedict Canyon Drive in the hills north of Sunset Boulevard. Most people who knew George were fond of Toni, feeling that she truly cared for him and that the two were a nice couple, despite the situation revolving around her marriage and whatever possible impact that could have on the clean-cut personality of the man who, for children around the world, was in fact Superman. Their affair was not just a physical thing, with many close to the couple having stated that they discussed marrying should Toni's husband, Eddie, ever pass away. Not all things were perfect, though. Toni was reportedly jealous and was always fearful that George was going to find someone younger to replace her. Despite her obvious affection for her younger lover, Toni was possessive and controlling, often limiting George's outgoing nightlife personality. Regardless, the two tended to get along well, with George jokingly referring to Toni as Ma, and Toni calling George the boy. Famed mobster Mickey Cohen once referred to Toni Mannix as the only person in Hollywood who had any balls. Things seemed to be looking up for George. Superman was a smash hit and garnered him international acclaim. 2 seasons in, George looked to get out from under the role and to break out on his own. He was 40 years old and looking to move on to bigger and better things, starting his own production company and working on the script for a new television series. Superman producers asked him to stay, but George was unhappy with his salary and excited about the possibilities of a new show over which he would have more control. Unfortunately, George failed to gain financial support for the series, and Superman producers offered him a salary increase, and so he continued on as the Man of Steel. George began feeling worse about his time as Superman. He was getting older and wasn't in as good a physical shape as he had once been. He was engaged in a constant back-and-forth battle. He both despised and was grateful for his fame as Superman. By 1958, his relationship with Toni was on the rocks, and her long-held fear came true. While out one evening, George met and began an affair with Lenore Lemon, the daughter of Arthur Lemon, a Broadway ticket broker. Rumors swirled about Lemon, the young fireball from New York who many believe was a troublemaker with connections to the mafia. Jack Larson, George's Superman co-star, would later say, quote, "She was well known to have been a party girl, and she was involved with Hoffa and all of that. Look what happened to Hoffa," end quote. Many have described Lemon as a perfectly sweet woman until she got a few drinks in her, at which point she became angry and had been known to throw her fists around when she felt slighted. Others were less kind, describing Lemon as a gold digger with a reputation for attaching herself to powerful men, milking them for what they were worth, and then moving on to the next target. The news was devastating to Toni, as she was reportedly crushed not just emotionally, but felt publicly humiliated. Their affair was over, and now Reeves was very publicly showing his relationship with Lemon, and had moved her into his home, a home which Toni herself owned. Things started to go downhill financially for George at this time. During his relationship with Toni, he'd been given large quantities of money, but now he was left without that extra income. Many of his close friends stopped spending time with him because of their distaste for Lemon. Jean LaBelle, a close friend of George's, would later say, quote, "She wasn't the kind of person you fall in love with. She was the kind of person that wants to run your life," end quote. In addition to this, weird things began happening, and George began to suspect Toni was the responsible party for several strange incidents that occurred throughout early 1959. He began receiving midnight phone calls, but when he answered, the person on the other end never spoke a word. Later, his beloved schnauzer, Sam, was kidnapped. In the months prior to his death, things took a more sinister turn. George was involved in three accidents while driving, which could have killed him, and he began to feel suspicious and paranoid about those around him. In the first incident, two trucks almost crushed George's vehicle while he was driving. During the second, a speeding car nearly collided with George head-on, but Reeves was able to get out of the way at the last moment. The third time was the most concerning. George was driving his prized Jaguar down a narrow, curvy road in the Hollywood Hills when his brakes failed. The vehicle crashed into a cement pillar, and George sustained a nasty head injury for which he would be prescribed painkillers. Strangely, an inspection by a mechanic revealed startling information. All of the brake fluid had been drained from his car, and the mechanic could find no issues with the vehicle that could have caused this to happen, suggesting that someone may have drained the fluid in an attempt to harm or even kill George Reeves. At the time, George was shaken and suspicious. He either wasn't sure of who may have been responsible or chose not to name who he believed it to be, but that would change over time. The midnight phone call stopped being silent, instead becoming long rants describing in grotesque detail the way in which the caller planned to murder Reeves. At their peak, there were as many as 20 phone calls per day. Frustrated and worried, Reeves went to the Los Angeles District Attorney and filed a report. When asked who he believed might be behind the incidents and phone calls, George suggested that they investigate Toni Mannix. The District Attorney's office launched an investigation and discovered that not only was George receiving threatening phone calls, but so was Toni Mannix. This discovery caused many to believe that this showed proof that Eddie Mannix, or someone he was connected to in the mafia, was involved, though others argued that Toni could have been lying about receiving calls in order to throw suspicion off of herself. George's luck began to change, though. He became engaged to Lenore Lemon, and his financial woes appeared to be getting solved. Superman was sold into syndication in Australia, and he was offered $20,000 to make an appearance as the Man of Steel. He had an exhibition boxing match scheduled against light heavyweight champion Archie Moore, and he'd been offered the director's chair on a new science fiction film entitled Return to Earth, for which he wanted his Superman co-star Phyllis Coates to play the lead. He also had plans to go back to Superman, for which he was being offered a considerable salary increase. According to friends, the 45-year-old was experiencing a resurgence in his career and was riding a high wave and feeling better than he had in years. He was hopeful about the future and looking forward to several projects, as well as his marriage to Lemon, with whom he had planned to honeymoon in Spain. Everything would change, though, on the night of June 15, 1959. There are several discrepancies in the events of the early evening, though I will present both sides of the story. According to multiple witnesses, George, Lemon, and Robert Condon were at Chasen's Restaurant, a very popular establishment for actors located in West Hollywood. The trio were sharing drinks. Condon was there interviewing Reeves for an article he was writing to be released in conjunction with an autobiography he was ghostwriting on Archie Moore. At some point, an argument ensued between George and Lemon, and they were seen outside of the restaurant shouting at one another. It's been alleged that the argument took place because Lemon suspected George of talking to his ex, Tony Mannix. There have also been statements made that Condon did not in fact accompany George and Lemon to the restaurant, and that the couple had much more than just a few drinks. There was some speculation at the time that George was interested in calling off their engagement, and that Lemon was none too pleased with his alleged change of heart. Later, when asked about this, Lemon denied being at the restaurant that evening and claimed that, instead, the pair had attended some wrestling matches. George was good friends with Gene LaBelle, a well-known wrestler and martial artist. According to Lemon, they had attended the matches by themselves and Condon was not in their company at the time and no argument took place. When asked about this later, LaBelle could not recollect having been involved in any wrestling matches on that day and definitely did not see George that night. Yet a third angle on this evening is that George and Lemon neither attended the wrestling matches nor met for drinks at Chasen's. According to this report, George and Lemon were home that evening hosting writer Robert Condon, and Lemon had prepared dinner for the trio to discuss the news article and the book. Following dinner, the three are reported to have gone into the living room to watch some television and went to bed around midnight. Details continue to get sketchy from here. According to Lemon, sometime around 1 a.m. there was a knock at the door. George and Lemon were known to frequently hold parties at the home, though George was open about the fact that he didn't want people showing up after midnight. Initially, they planned to ignore the knocking, but Lemon became frustrated and went downstairs to open the door. George is alleged to have put on his robe and come on down the stairs yelling at their guests, Carol Van Ronkel and William Bliss. Ronkel was a neighbor who lived a few streets down with her husband, screenwriter Rip Van Ronkel, and is also alleged to have been having an affair with George's house guest, Robert Condon. According to Lemon, Reeves calmed down and had a few drinks with the guests, but quickly excused himself upstairs to go back to bed, still annoyed by them showing up so late. According to Condon, George apologized for his bad temper prior to going upstairs to bed. At this point, according to the official police report, Lemon stated to the guests, quote, "He's gonna shoot himself," end quote. The group then heard the sound of a drawer opening, and Lemon continued, quote, "He's getting the gun out now, and he's going to shoot himself," end quote. At this point, the guests heard a gunshot. When asked about her statements later, Lemon told police that she was only kidding and didn't think George would actually shoot himself. Lemon would later say that George often joked around by firing a blank from his gun when he had guests over. William Bliss ran upstairs to check on George after the gunshot and found him naked, laying dead on his bed with his feet planted on the floor and his body facing upward. This led investigators to suspect that Reeves had been sitting on the end of his bed when he shot himself. A .30-caliber Luger pistol was laying on the floor between his feet. Interestingly, the police were not immediately called and didn't arrive at the home for nearly an hour. When asked about this, none of the witnesses present had any excuse as to why there was a 45-minute delay before they called, nor did they show any remorse for not calling immediately. It should be noted that all guests were heavily intoxicated when police arrived, leading some to theorize that the delay in the call was due to them getting rid of evidence of illegal drugs, while others have suggested that the delay points to a cover-up. Police later included in their reports that it was very difficult to get a coherent story from the extremely inebriated guests. Fred Crane, a friend of George's who had worked on Gone with the Wind with him, told a different story, though he was not present at the home that night. According to him, Bill Bliss had told several individuals that the official story was not the way things happened. According to this rumor, Bliss claimed to have been making a drink when the shot went off. He is then alleged to have said at this point, Lemon came down the stairs having been up in the bedroom when the shot went off and exclaimed, quote, tell them I was down here, tell them I was down here, end quote. George Reeves died of a single gunshot wound to the head in his upstairs bedroom between 1:30 and 2 a.m. on the morning of June 16, 1959. Strangely, the shell casing was found under his body, and the bullet was lodged in the ceiling, which is an odd trajectory for a man who is alleged to have put the gun to his own head and pulled the trigger, though it's not uncommon for bullets to do strange things when they enter the body. The Luger, though, had its shell ejection port on the right side, meaning that if George held the gun in his right hand, the shell should have ejected forward from him, not back behind him. There is the possibility that he could have held the gun with the ejection port facing up, which could account for the shell landing beneath the body, though it would have had to have ejected up and then fallen down faster than his body hit the bed. A private investigator later recreated the scene and found that, in order for the bullet to have ended up in the ceiling the way that it did, Reeves would have had to have had his head twisted at an uncomfortable angle when the trigger was pulled. However, this is not the end of the evidence contradicting the official story. Police found no fingerprints on the gun, though it was clear that the gun had recently been oiled, which could account for the lack of prints. There were also no powder burns on the body, which are typically associated with suicide and a gunshot wound in which the gun is held with close proximity to the body. For powder burns to not be present, the weapon had to be held at least 18 inches away from his head when it was fired. On the other hand, there have been instances in which powder burns were not present and a weapon was fired in close proximity. It's both been reported that gunpowder residue was not found on George's hands that night, though it has also been stated that it's possible that investigators didn't even check for it. There were a total of 5 bullet holes found in the bedroom, 3 of which were in the floor. Lemon would later explain away one of these bullet holes, claiming that she had accidentally discharged the weapon while fooling around with it one night, though the others go without explanation. Police also failed to treat the crime scene properly, not dusting for prints nor searching the property, and never taking any photographs of the scene or the body. They even allowed Lemon to wash the bloody sheets without processing them. Despite all of this evidence, which seems to suggest that the official story wasn't exactly accurate, police essentially followed a theory of suicide from the onset of the investigation, much to the dismay of George's friends, and especially his mother. The strange circumstances surrounding Reeves' death don't end there. Somehow, between the time of his death and the first autopsy, Reeves was embalmed. How exactly this error occurred, no one is sure, with some believing it's a case of confusion, and others suggesting police error, and still others feeling that this was manipulated to conceal evidence. The initial autopsy revealed no startling details other than the fact that, at the time of his death, George's blood alcohol content was a surprising 0.27%. Just as a note, the current legal level of a blood alcohol content is 0.08%, meaning that Reeves was over 3 times what would net you a DWI today. Some found this shocking, while others felt that George was a notoriously heavy drinker and they weren't surprised that he was so drunk that evening. According to the autopsy report, Reeves had loaded his gun, placed it to his right temple, and pulled the trigger, falling back onto the bed with his feet still planted on the floor. An interesting piece of information is that Reeves had injured his right hand in an accident just a few weeks prior to his death and had even filed a claim for disability due to his damaged hand. Police considered a combination of factors in their ultimate finding of suicide. George's blood alcohol content was a prime factor in their consideration. In their investigation of the home, they found no evidence of forced entry or of a second person being in the bedroom that night, Though, since Lemon lived there, it would be difficult to pinpoint any particular evidence to show that she had been in that room at that exact moment. Some have argued that there wouldn't have been signs of forced entry, since George tended to keep a so-called open house, where friends could come and go as they pleased, though the story of their friends banging on the door that night seems to suggest otherwise. Some of George's friends and house guests told a bizarre tale of George being a practical joker, and that he oftentimes fired a blank round from his gun to scare guests. Some have theorized that someone had slipped into the bedroom that night and replaced the blank shell in Reeves' Luger with a live round, though this wouldn't explain why Reeves would have placed the gun to his head when pulling the trigger in order to scare guests who weren't in the room. Others said that George had a tendency to play Russian roulette, and that on this particular night he lost. The latter was ruled out by investigators as there wasn't enough information to support the theory, and still didn't explain the lack of powder burns. George's mother, Helen, was strongly opposed to the finding of suicide, so much so that she had his body shipped across the country to have a second autopsy performed, and hired an attorney, Jerry Giesler, to petition the police to reopen the investigation. The second autopsy supported the possibility of a homicide, and also discovered a strange set of bruises on George's body, which may suggest that he had been hit or involved in a struggle prior to his death. In addition to this, Helen contacted the Nick Harris Agency and made contact with Milo Spiriglio, an investigator at the firm. Spiriglio later stated, quote, "Nearly everyone in Hollywood has always been led to believe that George Reeves' death was a suicide. Not everyone believed it then, nor do they believe it now. I am one of those who does not." End quote. The agency ultimately found the cause of death to be homicide, but the police department disagreed and stuck with their initial ruling of suicide. They speculated that Reeves was depressed about the direction of his career and his troubling money situation, and that his relationship with Lemon was becoming tense and he chose to end his own life. When faced with the suicide theory, Jean LaBelle was quoted as saying, quote, "I would bet my life on it that Lenore Lemon came up there, got a gun, and shot him." End quote. Shortly after George's death, Lemon returned to the home and cut down the police tape to gain entry to the house. She allegedly took liquor from the home, food from the refrigerator, and over $4,000 worth of traveler's checks which George had signed in preparation for their honeymoon. Lemon very quickly left town, heading back to New York, and didn't even attend George's memorial service. Lemon would distance herself in the passing years and had little to say about George's death. At the time, she allegedly told police that George had been depressed and that she couldn't say she was surprised that he committed suicide. Her life continued a downward trend following George's death, and she fell deep into alcoholism. Over the years, when she did rarely speak of that night, she gave several different accounts of what exactly happened. She died in 1989, alone in her apartment on New Year's Eve. Her corpse was not found for several days. Eddie Mannix died just a few years later, in August of 1964, taking most of his secrets with him to the grave. Tony, on the other hand, lived until 1983. She suffered from Alzheimer's disease towards the end of her life, and is reputed to have held twice weekly prayer circles in honor of George. Edward Losey, a Los Angeles publicist who befriended Tony later in her life, alleges that Tony, a devout Catholic, in her final days, confessed to a priest that she had hired someone to murder George. Jack Larson contradicts this statement, saying that he knew Tony well and had no doubt that she was not involved in George's death. He points to Tony's decaying state of mind as the reason behind any possible claim of her involvement, though Losey would go on to say that this happened more than once, and whenever Tony felt close to death, she called in a priest and gave him the same confession. Unfortunately, the information is unverifiable and can only be viewed as hearsay. As is typical of a death of a celebrity, especially one with so much chaos and confusion around it, many theories have sprung up in the 58 years since that fateful night. Some of these theories have been suggested by those who not only knew George, but the women and influences in his life. Others have been cobbled together by detectives and online theorists, authors, and just fans. The first theory is that which is listed as his official cause of death, that George Reeves, despondent over his failed career as an actor, stressing heavily from a depleted bank account, and struggling with a relationship in which he was no longer happy, made the choice to excuse himself from a gathering of friends, walked upstairs, entered his bedroom and in a severely drunken state produced a Luger handgun and shot himself in the head at approximately 1:20 a.m. The suicide theory does leave some room for the possibility of an accident, as many have heard the rumors that Reeves frequently played Russian roulette and decided, in a drunken stupor that night, to play a final round and lost. Another theory, which has gained great popularity in the years since Reeves died, is that George did not commit suicide and instead was shot by his fiancée Lenore Lemon. Many point to the fact that George and Lemon had a rocky relationship and that they'd been arguing earlier in the evening. They then factor in the large quantities of alcohol and possibly other substances in which the two indulged that night, and see it as a recipe for disaster. According to this theory, Lemon went upstairs with Reeves that night and argued with him. During the argument, it suggested that she fired several shots into the floor to get his attention, and when George became dismissive, or possibly angry, Lemon fired the killing shot. Others have theorized the possibility that Lemon, drunk and angry, accidentally shot George while attempting to scare him during their argument. Sticking on course with murder from an angry lover, the third theory is that Tony Mannix had George murdered. George suspected that Tony was behind the sabotaging of his car, and likely the one making the mysterious phone calls to him at odd hours of the night, and also likely the person behind the threats he would receive later. Though it was never specified whether it was her voice on the phone or that of someone else's, and George just assumed she had put them up to it. Phyllis Coates, George's co-star from Superman, later stated in the early morning hours of June 16th, within an hour of George's death, she received a frantic phone call from none other than Tony Mannix. Tony is alleged to have said, "The boy is dead," and went on to explain to Phyllis that George had been murdered, there were 5 bullet holes in the bedroom, and his sheets were in the washing machine. What's fascinating about this phone call is that it happened within an hour of George's death, and the police weren't even called until 45 minutes after he was shot. So many have been led to wonder how exactly Tony became aware of the death so quickly, and why she was so adamant that it was a murder. Theorists point to this story, as well as the fact that Tony was not only crushed by George's decision to leave her for Lemon, but she was well known, a powerful woman in Hollywood, and she had been publicly embarrassed by the incident. She was known to be jealous and possessive, and many people believe she took an approach that night that if she couldn't have George, no one could. Of course, Tony wasn't there that night, but many believe she likely had contacts with some of the darker men that her husband often employed for his alleged criminal activities. Which leads us to our final theory. Eddie Mannix was reputed to be a vicious man with more than one foot in the dark underbelly of society. Rumors abound about the kind of men he employed and the kind of activities he was involved in. Though Eddie was known to be friendly with George, often helping him out when he needed money or pulling strings to try and get him jobs, this all took place during a period in which George was having an affair with Eddie's wife. By all accounts, Eddie didn't mind this, and in fact it was part of an agreement between Eddie and Tony, but many theorized that all of that changed when George left Tony. According to this theory, Eddie not only empathized with and felt bad for Tony, but he was angry at the news because of the attention it brought him and the embarrassment. 1950s Hollywood was a different world than today, but much like now, public image was everything, and Eddie wasn't happy with his ruthless, powerful reputation being smeared by George's actions. Many believe that not only was Eddie responsible for George's murder that night, suggesting that he hired one of his mafia friends to conduct a hit, but that he was in fact the one behind the threats and sabotage. For a man who was already considered the likely culprit in his first wife's death, it wasn't a stretch for many to believe he could have easily manipulated the situation surrounding George's death. When you've got corrupt police in your pocket and killers at your disposal, it's almost impossible to not consider this theory. George Reeves was interred at Mountain View Cemetery in Altadena, California. Some years after his death, his body was exhumed and he was cremated and moved into the mausoleum. George's mother Helen died in 1964, never believing that her son had committed suicide. Her ashes were placed in the mausoleum beside her beloved George. The death of Superman spread around the world like wildfire, to the dismay of children and friends alike. It was a brutal shock to the system, and it had come at a time when the television series was set to come back in a major way. George Reeves was an American icon, reluctant though he may have been. To those who knew him and loved him, he was Honest George, a good man who had his demons, but who ultimately sought to be a stand-up guy, a trustworthy friend, and a devoted son. Though his case has been closed for over 50 years in the public record, for many, the details surrounding his final hours are suspect, and the truth about what led to his untimely death is a mystery that remains to this day. The death of George Reeves is one of those stories that I've heard about since I was a kid. I remember watching the original Superman television show replaying on Nick at Night, and my father came into the room. He talked about how he used to watch it when he was a kid, and he commented that there was always something strange about the way George Reeves died. I didn't think much of it at the time, I was just a kid watching a show. But when I got a little older and found myself drawn to shows like Unsolved Mysteries, I began to think about it. Unsolved Mysteries even covered George's case on one episode. It's a pop culture touchstone in a sense. I often find that people either know exactly who George Reeves is, and they've heard about some of the circumstances involving his death, or they've never heard of him at all. This case has a lot of twists and turns in it, a handful of possible suspects, and a lot of mystery and intrigue. It harkens back to the old days, the golden era of Hollywood, and for those of you who have dug into the history, you know that beneath the glitz and glam of Hollywood elite in the 1950s, there were a lot of dark secrets too. Torrid affairs, murder, drugs, cover-ups, and blackmail. Honestly, it probably wasn't all that different from the seedy side of Hollywood we're seeing in the news so much right now, except back then, it was a lot easier to put a lid on something and make sure it never got out. In terms of the death of George Reeves, many people suspect that the whole story never got out, and that was either due to weak police work or someone behind the curtain pulling their strings. Almost everyone who knew George, or was considered to maybe have been involved or known more information about his death, has passed away since then. Considering their deaths and the absence of evidence, this is a case that will most likely never be solved. There have been a few books written about it, several television shows have tackled the topic, and Ben Affleck starred in a 2006 movie titled Hollywoodland, which took on the case, though not very accurately. Suffice it to say, the death of George Reeves is one of those mysteries that just won't go away, and frankly, probably shouldn't. There's so much information involved that it's hard to get a handle on exactly what happened, and when your prime witnesses were incredibly drunk when the incident took place, it's hard to know which way is up. A quick note about the status of this case. I focus on unsolved cases, so why am I doing one that has a final determination? Well, I think there's enough information here to call that determination into question. As I've learned throughout these episodes, police make mistakes, and sometimes those mistakes lead to cases going unsolved. They determined that George Reeves committed suicide, but essentially since the day they made that announcement, there have been those who questioned their decision. There is evidence which contradicts the main story. I don't aim to be conspiratorial about it, but in some instances, it's important to examine everything and try to figure out what really happened. At the end of the day, George Reeves wasn't just a celebrity, and I think we often find it easy to dismiss something or someone because of their social status. Just like every other case I've covered, George was someone's son. He was a friend and a lover. He was a man who worked hard, and for children all around the world, he was the face of their hero. Should this case be ignored simply because it's been over 50 years and he was another Hollywood tragedy? I don't think so. And those who loved him agreed. I've wanted to cover this story for a long time, and I'm glad I'm finally being able to do so. So what really happened to George Reeves on that warm summer night in 1959? As you would expect, that's not such an easy question to answer. The first theory is the official theory, that a drunken, depressed George Reeves committed suicide. Police determined that George had shot himself based on the statements of the witnesses in the home that night, and the condition in which his body was found, naked, laying on the bed with his feet on the ground and the gun laying between them. Based on this quick decision, a lot of investigative steps that should have been taken were not. The fact that police failed to photograph the crime scene and the body makes it extremely difficult to go back and re-examine the case. You no longer have a crime scene to look at, and any details which may have been there to suggest anything other than suicide have been lost. The witnesses who were downstairs at the time of the gunshot all claimed that George was upstairs, alone. though neighbor William Bliss would later contradict that statement and allegedly admit that Lenore Lemon was in fact upstairs with George when he died. Police were frustrated. They had several drunken witnesses and a story which didn't make a lot of sense, but there were two factors involved in wrapping things up quickly. The scene looked as though it could have been a suicide, and at this particular time in Hollywood, it wasn't uncommon for police to go out of their way to protect a celebrity, though I've always felt that it's probably more damaging to your reputation to be known as a suicide instead of a homicide victim. What I don't understand is why they would choose to ignore all the evidence that points away from the suicide theory. The lack of powder burns on the body, the strange trajectory of the bullet, the presence of other bullet holes in the room. These alone are enough to make me wonder what happened there that night, and to feel as though the official story doesn't tell the true story. I believe the police thought they had an open and shut case, and it wasn't until later that they began to question things, but by that time it was too late. The body'd already been embalmed, the crime scene was no longer under seal, Lenore Lemon was gone, and anyone who was present that night likely had questionable memories based on the alcohol consumption. I believe they looked at George's autopsy results, saw his 0.27% blood alcohol level, and decided that he got drunk and killed himself. Strangely, they put forth a theory that George was upset about the direction of his career, was struggling with money troubles, and was severely depressed. Almost everyone who knew George at this time contradicts that statement. He had several projects under development, including one in which he would be directing. He had a trip to Australia planned out for which he was going to be paid $20,000, and he'd already mapped out his honeymoon with Lemon. Maybe things weren't so good in terms of his relationship with Lemon, but many suspect he was still in contact with Tony and was considering going back to her. These do not sound like the circumstances of a man who is severely depressed and desperate to end it all. On the other hand, we have seen in recent times famous men who have had it all and end up committing suicide. It's impossible to know what's in someone's head, and when you mix in a large quantity of alcohol, anything could be on the table. I can't say for sure whether or not George Reeves committed suicide that night. It's possible, but I do not believe there is so much evidence in favor of it that it's the only possibility. In a rare instance in this case, I also happen to agree with police that the Russian roulette stories are likely unfounded and merely speculative. The second theory is that George Reeves was murdered by his tempestuous fiancée, Lenore Lemon. Their turbulent relationship was well known, with even close friends of Reeves stating that Lemon was a big drinker, like George. But whereas George tended to be jovial when drunk, Lemon had a tendency towards anger and violence. Their relationship was strained, possibly due to financial troubles, or the suggestion that George may have been still keeping in contact with his ex-girlfriend, Toni Mannix. Lemon had a bad reputation, that of a gold digger who chose rich and powerful men and then left when she'd used them up or gotten what she wanted. She had previously married Jacob Webb, the great-great-grandson of Cornelius Vanderbilt. She left him just 8 days after they were married. George was, in a way, Lemon's entrance into the golden land of Hollywood. He was charming and intelligent, and most of all, he was famous. The two met at a nightclub and quickly became infatuated with one another. George is reported to have told several friends that he fell hard in love with her and would do anything for her, but many of these friends slowly felt they were ostracized from his life. They talked of Lemon being controlling and jealous, on top of being prone to violence. On the night George died, we have two severely contradictory stories about Lemon. In the first, she's downstairs with her guests when George goes up. She narrates his actions, saying that he's removing a gun from a drawer and putting it to his head. Moments later, they hear the shot, and Bliss runs upstairs to check on George and finds his body. Lemon would later tell police that she was only joking and didn't think Reeves would really do it. I've always found this story extremely strange, and I can't decide if that's because it sounds like the exact story you wouldn't want to tell police when you're investigating a death, or if it's because it represents Lemon as such a cold and careless woman. Bill Bliss, allegedly, later recanted his statement from that night and explained that Lemon had gone upstairs with Reeves, and that moments after the shot was fired, she came running down the stairs telling all the guests to tell police that she'd been with them the entire time. It's hard to know who's telling the truth here, But considering the gunshots in the floor and the odd trajectory of the bullet, I wouldn't be surprised if Lenore Lemon was the one who pulled the trigger. What I do find odd is that Bliss, as well as all the other guests there that night, would have agreed to lie for Lemon. The only real question to me is whether she did it in cold blood or if it was a drunken accident. I do believe it's entirely possible that Lemon killed George Reeves, and her behavior following the event shows a dramatic shift for someone who's supposed to have been his fiancée. She doesn't attend his funeral, she breaks into the sealed crime scene for liquor, food, and money, and then flees to New York. I use the term flee loosely, though that's how it's often described, but there was really not much for her to flee from, since police had already determined it was a suicide. To me, Lenore Lemon is just as viable a possibility as is the theory that George Reeves committed suicide. The third theory is also that of a jealous lover, this time being Tony Mannix. Tony and George were together for nearly 9 years, and for much of that they were a seemingly happy couple. Unlike his relationship with Lemon, George's friends described their situation as pleasant and good for both of them. Mannix had money and would lavish George with gifts and even bought the home that he lived in and ultimately died in. They had a good relationship, though they had to live their lives somewhat concealed due to Tony's status as a married woman. Everyone involved claims that this was a very open secret in Hollywood. But again, it was a different time, before the days of the paparazzi, where reporters often showed an extra level of discretion when it came to celebrities. Everything went sideways, though, when George left Tony for Lemon. Tony despised Lenore Lemon, whether it be because she was the person who replaced her, or because her lover left her. We may never know. Many people theorized that Tony was behind the sabotaging of George's car, as well as the late-night threatening phone calls. They take it a step further and present a case that Tony Mannix hired someone, likely one of her husband's connections, to murder George that night. The question becomes, how would the killer have gotten in and out of the home unnoticed? This is where Bill Bliss comes in. Bliss wasn't a frequent attendee of George's home, and many have considered the possibility that the entire purpose of him coming to the house that night was in order to create a distraction, wherein a hitman could enter the home via the back door and sneak upstairs while the party was going on. After murdering Reeves, it's assumed that the killer climbed out a window and disappeared into the night. It sounds a little too fanciful for me, and if that were the case, I feel like there would probably have been evidence to indicate this. Then again, the investigation was so poorly handled, it's hard to know that there wasn't more evidence. Tony certainly had the money and the ability to pull this off, but for me, there's one thing that's always bothered me. Tony loved George, and I know people do crazy things when they're in love, but it feels to me like it would have been much more likely that Tony would have killed Lenore Lemon instead. She's the person to whom most of Tony's anger was directed, and there have been rumors that George and Tony were talking again, which is alleged to have been a point of strife between Reeves and Lemon. Now, perhaps Tony wanted to kill George and frame Lemon for it, but if that was her plan, it didn't work out very well. We know that Tony held prayer circles for George twice a week for the rest of her life, and in that her older state, and with her mind weakened due to Alzheimer's disease, she's alleged to have admitted to several Catholic priests that she had George killed. I've got a few problems with this, which essentially go to corroboration. The man who came forward with this information didn't tell the story at the time. He waited several years, until after Tony had passed away. In addition to this, is it really wise to take the words of a woman who's suffering from a horribly degenerative brain disorder? Not exactly the most reliable confession. Although I can absolutely see where people get the theory that Tony Mannix was involved, I honestly don't believe she was, unless she was in a less active role. And that's where the next theory comes in, that George Reeves was in fact murdered by someone under the orders of Tony's husband, Eddie Mannix. Eddie Mannix, at the time, was an executive working for MGM Studios, but known all around as a fixer, the guy big stars went to when they had a problem that they needed to go away. He was reputed to have friends in a lot of different areas of Hollywood, including the darker parts. Mannix was rumored to have been connected to the mafia, and didn't rule out the use of thugs to strong-arm and in many cases assault people who got in his way. There's a lot of controversy around the death of his first wife, Bernice. In 1933, Bernice filed for divorce, despite both she and Mannix being devout Catholics. She accused him of infidelity and of physically abusing her. Before the divorce could go through, Bernice was killed in a car accident outside of Palm Springs, allegedly after leaving a club owned by one of Eddie's associates. Many believe that Mannix arranged for Bernice to be killed in order to protect his reputation and as revenge for her filing divorce and her accusations. His marriage to Tony was different in that both carried out extramarital affairs and both were okay with doing so. Many have said that Eddie liked George and approved of the relationship. However, when George left Tony, she was absolutely devastated and it didn't make her or Eddie look great. Many believe that Eddie arranged to have George murdered and that it was either done as revenge for leaving Tony and hurting the couple's reputation, or that it was done as revenge for Reeves hurting Tony's feelings. Either way, many theorize that Mannix went back to his typical habits and arranged for someone to execute the Superman actor. In the months leading up to his death, Reeves was threatened and had his vehicle sabotaged. Some believe that Eddie was behind all of this, and when the district attorney investigated these incidents, he found that Tony herself was receiving threatening phone calls as well, leading some to believe that Eddie planned to have her murdered as well. It isn't hard to imagine a man like Eddie Mannix could have easily been involved in the death of George Reeves. He had plenty of motive, and obviously had people under his employ who were capable of committing murder and getting away with it. Mannix is one of the few people suspected in this murder who had the political clout and financial strength to not only pull this off, but to manipulate the situation and cover it up through the use of bribes, corrupt officials, and public media. Whether or not Tony was involved, we may never know. To me, there are two possibilities when it comes down to who could have killed or been involved in the murder of George Reeves: Lenore Lemon or Eddie Mannix. Lemon's motives may have been purely emotional or related to alcohol, while Mannix was cold and calculating, and certainly had a much greater history of being able to pull off crimes and get away with them. If indeed the bullet that killed George Reeves wasn't fired by his own hand, then the next person on the list should definitely be Eddie Mannix. George Reeves died over 58 years ago when he was just 45 years old and about to embark on the second major boom of his career. Since that time, countless books, television shows, and movies have discussed and speculated about his death. To this day, Superman is an American icon of truth, justice, and the American way, and yet the man who famously donned the cape and tights may have died without either truth or justice. His mother went to her grave believing her son was murdered, and many of George's friends strongly agreed. Hollywood was embroiled in a quiet debate, whispered in the dark corners and booths of clubs and restaurants, never feeling fully satisfied with the outcome. The police essentially washed their hands of the case and have chosen to never look back at what many view as a terribly flawed investigation. The death of George Reeves will forever be a mystery that draws interest from those young and old, and stands as a horrible reminder of the darkness that lurks beneath the spotlight and glamour of old, as well as current-day, Hollywood. If you're interested in finding more information about the death of George Reeves, there are many websites and books. One I would recommend is called Hollywood Kryptonite, as well as an episode of Unsolved Mysteries and E's Mysteries and Scandals. If you have information about the death of George Reeves, please contact the Los Angeles Police Department or the FBI. What do you believe happened to George Reeves? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. For those of you who don't know, Trace Evidence has a Patreon page where you can help support the podcast. It's located at patreon.com/traceevidence. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence and invite you to check out the website at trace-evidence.com. You can find links to the Patreon, all social media accounts, as well as places to download and subscribe to the podcast. I'm always eager to hear your feedback, so if you enjoyed this episode, please give us a good rating on iTunes and leave us a review. This will greatly help our reach and bring more attention to the cases we cover. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman, strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Superman, who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands, and who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way. And now, another exciting episode in the Adventures of Superman.